From high atop Fox News headquarters in New York City, always seeking solutions, never sowing division, it's Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the latest moment of the Brian Kilmeade Show. It is Thursday. So glad you're here. This hour, we're going to be joined by one of my favorite guests, Senator Lindsey Graham. He is fresh off a series of overseas trips, in touch with President Trump on a regular basis. Got a sense of what the chances are of getting some Ukraine funding in, and maybe where he used to work at the House, the chance of recalling Speaker Johnson if it does indeed happen. A lot going on. We know if you're looking for the Vice President of the United States, she's going to be in North Carolina because we're talking about 2024. So let's get to the big three.
Now, with the stories you need to know, it's Brian's Big Three.
Number three.
I think the evidence of her bias is pretty palpable at this stage of the game. Jack Smith, the filing today, makes it plain that she has to rule. And if she doesn't rule, under either scenario, they'll be in a position to take her up to the 11th Circuit. And I think the 11th Circuit will likely take her off the case.
Well, that's what Ty Cobb hopes, because he's vehemently anti-Trump now. The Trump trials, documents case, a delay. A compromised judge forges ahead in New York, despite his myriad of conflicts. What it could mean for the former president's quest to get back into the Oval Office. And what he was referring to, Ty Cobb, was the documents case. I'll have more on that.
Number two, I feel that Joe will be reelected.
But when these polls, like the Wall Street Journal one, land in the White House and he's losing in all the battleground states.
No, he's not losing in all the battleground states. He's coming up and he's even or doing better.
Right, Jill. I'm sorry. The Wall Street Journal poll has a different conclusion than you. So I will call the Wall Street Journal and tell them they got it all wrong. Joe is trailing in every battleground state. Sorry, Mrs. Biden. His wife may be in denial, but you are not. His campaign is now changing out pollsters and rallying around abortion as Trump focuses on the border. What messages resonates with you?
Number one.
In many cases, you're arresting the same people over and over again. This is a serious issue, and it's past time that we start taking it seriously. New Yorkers are fed up with the revolving door.
That is Police Commissioner Caban. Unacceptable. Once again, judges are releasing criminals, illegal immigrants on top of that, and putting all of us in danger and cops in danger as they arrest them, and arrest them again. The latest examples of criminal squatters in the Bronx is emblematic of the bigger problem, leaving cops in the line of fire. Meanwhile, this is just over a week since Jonathan Diller was shot to death and his partner was almost killed if the gun didn't malfunction. We're picking up people that have committed myriad of crimes. I'm talking about in the case of Guy Rivera, the killer of Jonathan Diller, 21, and is the driver of the car, 14. They've been to jail twice. And now, I just thought it was important, and I don't like to focus on individual cities, especially just because it's a city I'm in, and make you think it's a national problem, but this is one time I'm doing it because it's a national problem. So, over the weekend, the NYPD raided a house, because in the basement were a bunch of squatters. They were all illegal immigrants. All a problem. The neighborhood had been complaining. There was 8 motorcycles there, drugs coming out. Drugs were on the insides, ketamine, whatever that is, but it's lethal. So they pull out all these migrants. 4 of the 8 migrant squatters were arrested with drugs and guns, previously skipped out of processing appointments. So if you and I ever miss a court date, there's a warrant for our address. These guys miss a court date, a warrant for their address. They still squat. They get in front of a judge. And the judge lets him off. And who is that judge? Eugene D. Bowen. What is his background? I can't tell you. But I can tell you what he did 2 months ago when those 2 cops got beat up by the 12 Venezuelan illegal immigrants. He let them out. And remember when the guy flashed the middle finger to all of us as he got out after processing? That was his doing. And then ICE sprung into action when it came to what's happening in the Bronx over the weekend, and they arrested 4 of them. The other 4 are out. So what did they do? What's the big deal? Hey, be easy. We're a nation of immigrants. Why don't I just back off? Well, Yossi Castillo, and I hope I mispronounced his first name, but it's spelled quite challenging. But Border Patrol encountered him near Brownsville. The Border Patrol released her into the U.S., an alternative to detention on a condition of a parole due to detention capacity. So we had no room to put him in a soft-sided facility, a tent, so we let him out. The Woodward Police Department say in January, They arrested Pinto on crimes for shoplifting. Maybe she learned her lesson. Don't think so. On March 27th, the NYPD arrested Pinto for crimes in criminal possession of a weapon, second-degree murder, loaded firearms, criminal possession with weapons, second degree. Maybe they learned their lesson. Don't think so. April 3rd, apprehended without incident, pursuant to a 1-200 warrant of arrest. She will remain in custody pending removal proceedings. Good. That's the one they kept. Now, meanwhile, what about Martinez, this guy Armando Martinez? What did he do wrong? Well, he crossed into the country illegally on the 22nd. An alternative to detention, we had no room. We let him out on parole. They said, you better be good. He wasn't. March 27th, arrested for crimes of criminal possession of a weapon, second-degree loaded firearm, criminal possession of a weapon, second-degree loaded firearm in on a school grounds on top of that. What could go wrong there? I think it's PS-56. Criminal possession of a controlled substance. So on drugs with guns in front of a school. Guess what? Apprehended and let go. Hector Villata. Well, he crossed in May 3rd, 2023. Told him to be good. We have no room for you. You're on your own with Congressman. Be good. Didn't happen. August 28th, 2023. Yonkers Police Department picked up D'Souza for crimes of assault, intent to cause serious injury with a weapon, and attempted murder. So, to me, you made a huge mistake letting him out, and now we got him before he killed. So what happens to him? Nothing. March 27th, he's arrested for crimes of criminal possession of a weapon, second-degree loaded firearm, criminal possession of a weapon, second-degree loaded firearm on school grounds, criminal possession of a controlled substance, and intent to sell drugs, and act in a manner to injure a child less than 17. So he's around kids, around schools, with guns, assault, and can I add drugs? Still here. April 3rd, that's when the NYPD apprehended D'Souza without incident. He will remain in custody pending removal proceedings. We'll see what happens. The rest got out. So I could bore you with other rundowns of things that should appear on wanted photos, but I'm not going to do it. Can I just tell you, all criminals, all laughing in the face of our free stuff that we give them, all squatting, all ruining neighborhoods. You know, you make $50,000, $70,000 a year. You buy, a two-bedroom house. You feel good at being in it. They're an attached house in Queens. I don't know if you've ever seen them before. Think All in the Family's 1970s, if you've seen some of this video. And you're very proud of it, and you should be. You're paying probably $15,000 a year in taxes. You probably paid for the house now $500,000, $450,000. You're paying off a mortgage. Hopefully it's not an adjustable because it would be at 7%. But if you got it low, maybe 2.7%. And you feel good about yourself. You're raising your kids. And then you look down the block, and that same block, 9 motorcycles, drugs coming out, garbage everywhere, dangerous characters on the inside, dangerous characters coming in on the outside. The NYPD cannot cooperate with ICE because, like Chicago, San Francisco, Los Angeles, Seattle, they're not allowed. They are sanctuary cities. Here's the police commissioner, cut 3.
We have seen one factor become very clear. In many cases, we are arresting the same people over and over again. When it comes to committing crime, the risks just don't outweigh the rewards, and the lack of consequence makes it easy to reoffend without a second thought. This is incredibly frustrating to law enforcement. This is a serious issue, and it's past time that we start taking it seriously. New Yorkers are fed up with the revolving door.
Listen, Caban got, he was the guy who shook the president's hands, thanked him for coming over in Massapequa on Jonathan Diller's shooting. And people say they like him, but Keechit Sewell was much better. The female police chief, they loved her. I think she was third in command in Nassau County. And she was so frustrated by the lack of support from the mayor and from the city council and from the state. She goes, I quit. And as soon as she quit, everyone said, this is a disaster. This guy is limited. He's not Ray Kelly. He's not Commissioner Bratton. But at least he's sincere. And his hands are thoroughly tied. So I want you to hear from Chief John Chell. It could be Sal. It's my bad for not knowing that. But here's what he said. Cut 7.
This is 2 days after Detective Diller's murder. The same situation where we should have been there. The two people in that car, two violent convicted felons with two firearms. And at the very least, the driver, who has two convictions, one for attempted murder, one for robbery with shots fired, with another firearm, indicted in Queens, out on bail, as far as we're concerned, I'm concerned, should have been remanded. We should not have been there. Our cops should not have been there.
He says our cops shouldn't have been there in Queens last Monday, and our cops shouldn't have been there in the Bronx with that squatter's home with all these criminals who are just blown off court appearances, who are laughing in the face of our Border Patrol, who are here on parole committing a myriad of crimes. And now that they get processed, they get recommended $150,000 bail from the DA in New York City, and the judge says, nope, they can go. So ICE sprung into action. My hope is the NYPD told ICE, says, I'm not supposed to cooperate with you, but you know what? What's your number? Let me text you. I hope. I don't have any proof of that. My hope is ICE moved in the next day. So we're going to take a time out and see what you think about that. 1-866-408-7669. I tell you this story about New York because it's not a New York story. It's a Chicago story. It's a Philadelphia story. It's everywhere. And if you're not living in the city, you're staying away from the city because that's happening in your city. You're listening to The Brian Kilmeade Show.
Diving deep into today's top stories, it's Brian Kilmeade.
I'm Guy Benson. Join me weekdays at 3 p.m. Eastern as we break down the biggest stories of the day with some of the biggest newsmakers and guests. Listen live on the Fox News app or get the free podcast at GuyBensonShow.com.
If you're interested in it, Brian's talking about it. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
People know the choice this election. They can choose chaos or they can choose, you know, steady wisdom experience. So
there's not a part of you that's a little worried because
no,
you seem to be
no,
off kilter a little
no,
bit.
No, okay. I feel that Joe will be reelected.
But when these polls, like the Wall Street Journal one, land in the White House and he's losing in all the battleground states.
No, he's not losing in all the battleground states. He's coming up and he's even or doing better.
Look, I don't blame her defending her husband, but you can't lie about numbers. It's like the Mets are winless. They're in dead last. The only winless team in the National League. I think in all Major League Baseball. If I said, no, they're not. They've won before. You'd say, you might be a Met fan, but you cannot make up that they are winless. That's not up to you. That's the poll. And you want to diminish the poll? Fine. Okay, now you don't like the Wall Street Journal? All right. But this has been a trend. Now, I think they have tightened it up a little bit since the State of the Union, just a little bit. But I thought the State of the Union was hideous. It was a campaign speech at a time in which you're supposed to show everyone why you're a great president. So let's go inside the Wall Street Journal numbers for a second. President Biden standing with young and minority voters. In 2020, he had 91% of the black vote. Now he has 68. And I know it's a poll, but it shows a snapshot. Hispanic voters, he had 63%. That was concerning back then. And now he's got 48%, which means he's losing. Voters under 30, he needs to dominate. He had 61% last time. Now he's got 50%. So, Jill, you could say, snap at anybody you want, and you could tell he's not losing. Now, Joe Biden does the same thing. Multiple times, you know, you're trailing in the polls. What polls? The last six polls I'm winning. What are you even talking about? There was a Quinnipiac poll with him up in the national poll. But he has not been winning in Michigan, not been winning in Georgia, not been winning in Arizona. He's not been winning in Pennsylvania. And now he's in a flat-footed tie to Wisconsin. And it's going to be a tough for the president, the former president, to win in Wisconsin. But he wants to, obviously. But he thinks he can make up for it by flipping Nevada. So I'm surprised Georgia's so close because abortion's no longer on the menu there. So Jill Biden snaps. So what has President Biden's done? Do you remember 2 weeks ago we told you that President Obama has been calling up and he's been telling Joe Biden and his chief of staff, Jeff Zients, I'm really concerned. He goes, you haven't built out your team. It is way too small. You're not spending the money that you have. Where are your people? Where are your pollsters? I think it's related to this news. Now they have now decided to bulk up on their pollsters. John Anzalone is now joining their team. He was a campaign. He's going to be in control. He is very popular on the Democratic side. Celinda Lake is going to be there, led a team of about five pollsters, helping the eventual nominee track down key states in 2020. That was Joe Biden. Jeffrey Pollack is now joining them. He worked for Governor Pritzker and Nevada Senator Jackie Rosen. He had success in Molly Murphy, who served as the leading poll advisor to the Democratic congressional campaign. I think that he is bulking it up. Now, they're going to go out there and try to find samples and try to find weaknesses within the numbers. So they're not going to depend on the Wall Street Journal. Do you know when people say my internals are different than what the public polls say? These are the internal pollsters. So you can judge by the actions of where they go about what these pollsters come up with. So we'll look to do it forensically. Kellyanne Conway was on with Laura last night, and he talked about how Jill Biden's answer is really what Democrats have been saying, maybe not out loud. Cut 14.
Most of them are in denial, Laura. They look at these polls, they pretend what they don't see. We look at the southern border, they pretend we don't see it. All the issues, Joe Biden is underwater. He's disapproved more than he's approved on all the major issues in those same polling. The Fox News polls, the Wall Street Journal polls, the horse race is one thing. It's impressive for Trump at this early stage. But it's the handling of the issues, and it's the more negative than positive towards Joe Biden personally and presidentially that is really the problem that he has. I'm not even sure Dr. Jill's an asset anymore.
She has to be an asset because he's got nobody else. He is not doing interviews. He's not doing press conferences unless he has to. I'm not sure he's got anything on the docket. He said he's going to do podcasts. All right, good luck. Jason Bateman, he's going to be on every week. So how are the Republicans vulnerable? They're vulnerable because some people just are against Trump. And they're vulnerable on abortion. And those states that haven't put abortion up for a referendum, that haven't done what Ohio and Kansas have done, what might all of a sudden mobilize people to get into play and make some Senate seats a little iffy? For example, Florida. Does Senator Rick Scott worried because now on the ballot will be a six-week ban or a 23-week ban? Mark Penn weighed in last night. Remember, he's one of the co-founders of No Labels. He's a Clinton pollster. Cut 16.
When you look at our polls, the Harris poll, really Trump's by winning about by 2 points, which means he's winning by 2 to 5 in a lot of the swing votes, swing states. And I think that's exactly what you see. I think the key swing voters are going to be these suburban women voters. And they are going to be cross-pressured between the economy that they don't see as good and what they see as a fundamental right to abortion. And in Florida now, given that DeSantis put in a six-week bill, they're now going to be on the ballot a 23-week bill. So the choice isn't going to be 15 weeks or not. It's going to be 6 or 23. And this could bring a lot of Democrats out in Florida. So this is a good issue for the Democrats in this current political environment in a close race where Trump is leading.
Trump is going to get out in front of this. He said it yesterday. I'm very curious to see what he's going to do because there's got to be a messaging there. How many election losses do you need? I know you could be as pro-life. Everyone listening to me right now might be pro-life. But if it's losing you elections, you have less and less power, and gradually you're going to lose that too. Senator Lindsey Graham is next. He had a great idea, I thought, how to handle this if you're a Republican. We'll talk about that and everything else.
Radio that makes you think. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
While there may have been times over the years where individual threats could have been higher here or there than where they might be right now, I've never seen a time where all the threats, or so many of the threats, are all elevated all at exactly the same time. That's what makes this environment that we're in now so fraught, and why funding our men and women who are working shoulder to shoulder with state and local law enforcement and other partners every day makes it even more important, not less.
So blinking red lights analogy about 9/11, all the lights were blinking red before 9/11. Apparently, obviously, all of us missed it. Would you say that there's multiple blinking red lights out there?
I see blinking lights everywhere I turn.
How scary is that? It didn't get enough attention. Senator Lindsey Graham joins us now to change that. That was a couple of months ago. And now you look at the attacks in Iran and the attacks in Russia. And now ISIS-K considers us the next victim and the primary focus. Senator Lindsey Graham joins us now. Senator, welcome back. Your thoughts about that exchange?
Well, this was almost a couple of months ago. We're not acting on the information being provided. The Biden administration's military budget is pathetic. This budget deal was bad. The Navy is going to go down in ships at a time that China is getting bolder. Our ability to detect and disrupt operations in Afghanistan after our withdrawal doesn't exist. When Joe Biden said, President Biden said, we would have over the horizon capability to disrupt operations in Afghanistan and protect our homeland, that's proven not to be correct. This past weekend, General McKenzie said that the attacks in Moscow foreshadow what's coming here. He believes the attack on the homeland from ISIS-K is almost inevitable. And we're not doing anything. We're not trying to generate capability to hit ISIS-K in Afghanistan before they hit us. We're just sitting around and watch millions of people flow into the country unchecked. You check into an app, that's all you have to do. You could lie your way into the system very easily or just literally walk across the border. So I've never been more worried about another 9/11 than I am right now.
You know why? Because, Senator, you used to have a lot of people understand the threat after 9/11 and then Iraq and then ISIS comes out of nowhere. We all were on the same page. We have gotten complacent because, thankfully, we have not been hit by a terror attack. We're all happy about that. And then we see our enemies get hit and we think, okay, that's nothing to do with us. But we actually tipped off Iran and Russia. Does that show you that maybe we're on top of things?
Yeah, I think our capability needs to be enhanced. The intelligence community doing a good job with what they have. They actually gave information to Russia very specific about the nature of the attack, and Russia basically ignored it. So, yeah, you do get complacent. People get war weary. You know, what, 19, 20 years after World War One, we have World War Two. About 20 years after 9/11, we withdrew from Afghanistan. And the rest is history. ISIS-K and al-Qaeda are coming back there and other places. So what I worry about is that the ability that President Biden described to deal with terrorism in Afghanistan over the horizon, not on the ground there, doesn't exist. And they're getting stronger all over the region. They're coming back on the border of Iraq and Syria. And we have 900 troops in Syria, a few thousand in Iraq. But President Biden and, quite frankly, the Congress, we're not upping our game given the threat we face.
So this is not going to make you feel better, but it's important for somebody like General Frank McKenzie, who was part of the evacuation, the disastrous evacuation of Afghanistan. We'll talk about that again, but here he is. Cut 35.
Well, I think we have enough in Iraq and in Syria to conduct operations against ISIS, the remnants of ISIS in the Euphrates River Valley and in eastern Syria. And, of course, Martha, you also remember our SDF partners, our partners there are sitting on top of a prison system with approximately 10,000 ISIS fighters that are incarcerated in it. If that prison system were to open up, would let forth on the world a whole new chapter of ISIS violence. So that's very important to us. On the other hand, in Afghanistan, we have almost no ability to see into that country and almost no ability to strike into that country. And so ISIS there is able to grow unabated. There's no pressure on them.
So that doesn't make you feel better, but it's exactly your point.
Well, I've sent in a letter to Senator McConnell and Schumer asking that the Senate be given a classified briefing about the nature of the threat, how real is it, how broken our border is and how it relates to terrorism, what capability do we have regarding Afghanistan, if any. And here's my point. You may be tired of finding them. They're not tired of finding you. When it comes to striking America by radical Islamists, that's the gold medal in the jihadist Olympics. You know, everything else is a silver or a bronze medal. Their number one goal is to hit us where we live. And General McKenzie's, you know, evaluation that we're sort of deaf, dumb, and blind in Afghanistan is true. And these guys are getting bolder. And our response is inadequate. So I would like to have an emergency meeting of the United States Senate where we're briefed about the nature of the threat, and try to come up in real time with some response.
Yeah, their problem, I mean, they're also at war with the Taliban, correct?
Oh, yeah. ISIS and the Taliban, okay, there's three groups here. The Taliban, basically, you know, radical Islamists who want to control Afghanistan.
Teamed with Al-Qaeda.
A lot more. Yeah, yeah. That's the Taliban. Al-Qaeda is the long-range radical Islamists. They're the original tenet. But they're like the Rotary Club compared to ISIS. ISIS wants to establish the caliphate now and not wait around for things to change. So ISIS is, you know, ISIS are made up of people that the Taliban and Al-Qaeda kick out. They're too crazy for the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. These people are nuts. And they will slaughter as many people as they can if they have the capability.
Right.
So I'm trying to – Katie Britt, Senator Britt from Alabama, she's on top of this too. We're making a plea to the Senate leadership. Let's have a meeting. Let's discuss what's going on and react before it's too late.
So I look forward to better answer your question. That's a non-political request that you have that has our national security. You know, my worry is everyone's come out and warned us already, and they could honestly say, I told you so. So it's really on us to take action, or people in control to take action. So the FBI can honestly say, I told you seven times last 2 years that this was going to happen, but you left the border open and you're not tracking people that were on the FBI watch list. So it's insanity that you have to come on and go through the media to get people's attention. But I'm glad you're doing it. Senator, I gotta also ask you about the attack in Russia. They came from Tajikistan, correct?
Right.
And they
right.
came in because they were mobilized, and they pull off an epic kill for all the ugly reasons in a concert hall. We warned Russia ahead of time. They thought we were being smug, I guess, ignored it. We even told them the concert hall, and now he blames Ukraine. So is ISIS-K not getting the traction that they wanted?
Well, no, I think they made their point. They certainly made it to me. And, you know, this is just Russian propaganda. They were really well informed. Our intelligence service did the Russian people a great service, and Putin let his own people down. So what you see here, ISIS-K has got a foothold physically in Afghanistan. They're involved in almost every province now. But they're able to recruit from around the world for, you know, a few $1,000s and get people to sign up and do almost anything. Remember when the caliphate was established in Iraq and Syria?
Yep.
Around Raqqa, Syria. They projected force. They attacked the concert hall in France. They killed thousands of people while they had a caliphate. The more organized they are, Brian, the more territory they control, the more money they have, the more dangerous they are. They took the oil revenue in Syria and funded their operations. So they're not back to that level, but they're growing. They're growing in Afghanistan, and they're recruiting throughout the world.
Mm-hmm.
And it only takes a handful of these guys willing to die themselves to wreak havoc. And again, with a broken border, how easy is it to get into our country? And I believe Mayorkas and all of these people in charge of our homeland, Director Ray could not, he did everything but take an ad out in the paper. They're going to hit us, and we're not doing much in response. So the Biden administration is just sitting there like with deer in headlights.
So a couple of things real quick on Ukraine aid. Do you believe from – I know it's a different chamber, but do you believe the Speaker Johnson's going to put something on the floor, a standalone bill, when he gets back?
Yeah, he's going to put something on the floor. And if you thought it was a bad idea to leave Afghanistan because the terrorists would come back and do what they're doing, giving Russia a victory in Ukraine after Ukraine has fought so hard would be even worse. So to those who criticize the withdrawal in Afghanistan, you're right. To those who believe we should just pull the plug on Ukraine, you're deadly wrong. China's watching. Putin will not stop. So here's what I think the speaker will do. He'll put an aid package, more weapons, let the Europeans deal with the economic problems that Ukraine have. We'll do more weapons. It'll be a loan like President Trump suggested. You know, Ukraine has about $6 to $12 trillion of critical minerals underneath its land. That's one reason Russia invaded. Over the arc of time, they may be able to pay us back, but it'd be a no-interest forgivable loan, but we need to change the way we do business here. And we're going to go after frozen Russian assets all over the world to help pay for this war, so, and some border security. So I think Speaker Johnson's rising to the occasion. And people who just say, "Is you missed all of World War II. How could any reasonable person expect the world to be safer if we give Putin what he wants by force of arms? How does any reasonable person believe he'll stop in Ukraine when he says he'll keep going? How can you not connect what China would do with what we're doing in Ukraine? It's just insanity, right, in my view. It's an ostrich approach to the world. The world is connected for good and bad.
And this is, you know, I agree with you. But I'm going to, this is with the critics have a legitimate point when they talk about the slow walking of weapons and the lack of being able to express what the objective is and express to the American people and give them the respect they deserve to talk about the objective. And now, when you see Secretary of State Blinken criticizing Ukraine for blowing up a Russian oil field because it was in Russia, that's the frustration, Senator.
Well, let's lay out, you know, this is radio, it makes you think. Well, let's think a little bit. What are we trying to do here? We're trying to maintain the territorial integrity of Ukraine, because if we don't, then we're going to have more war on the continent of Europe. The last time somebody tried to take another country by force of arms was Adolf Hitler. They speak German. They really want to be with us. Well, you know what? Crimea is a debated area, but Crimea was part of Ukraine when they gave up their 1,700 nuclear weapons in the 90s. So what Putin's done is destroying world order. He will not stop. So we should have given them the tanks earlier. We should give them a long-range artillery to knock the bridge down between Crimea and Russia. We should have trained them on the F-16s last year. You're dead right. They need more capability. The Biden administration has been slow-walking. It's like they don't want to lose, but they don't want to win.
I know.
What is winning? Winning is continuing to degrade the Russian forces inside of Ukraine, get close to Crimea militarily, and get a sue for peace on favorable terms,
yes,
where Ukraine becomes part of NATO, part of the European Union, and there'll be no third invasion. That's possible with the right weapons.
And I'll tell you, I'm going to end this with the way I would Admiral Stavridis today. Every Republican I talk to speaks in glowing terms of Ronald Reagan. Everyone. The most extreme right and the most moderate right. And would Ronald, ask yourself, would Ronald Reagan give Ukraine the weapons they need? And I know the answer. What do you think the answer is?
It's a resounding yes, but let's talk about what maybe Trump and Reagan had in common. Do you believe they would have invaded on Reagan's watch? I don't think they would have invaded on Trump's watch. It went back to Afghanistan.
Weakness,
they saw
weakness
in Afghanistan. And the rest is history.
And China sees weakness if we stop. And it's beyond a lot. We'll have to, this will be the Republican
radio
version of Afghanistan.
Makes you think.
Well, I like that. Senator, it's great talking to you. We need 2 hours.
All right, buddy.
And I'll work on that.
See you soon.
All right. Senator Lindsey Graham. When we come back, I'm going to be able to squeeze in a few calls on the other end. Or you can write me, BrianKilmeade.com. I get it. There's some legitimate criticisms about so-called endless war. And when the President of the United States says we're going to do it as long as it takes, your eyes roll in your head. Especially because he doesn't do anything right on foreign policy, even though he's the most experienced. But the objective is the right one for the country. Don't let the president get in the way of doing the right thing.
Coming to you on a need-to-know basis, because, man, do you need to know. It's Brian Kilmeade. Breaking news, unique opinions. Hear it all on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Well, I think it helps him a lot. There's a big body of evidence in polling that a conviction in any of these cases, but in these federal cases in particular, would be harmful to him. And his goal has been clearly throughout to try and delay all of these trials beyond the election. So it feels like this judge who he appointed is in the tank, and she's done what he wanted, which is to help delay this trial beyond where it could be tried before this election.
So what he is referring to, David Axelrod, and I like putting guys like him on, Karl Rove on, to other sides, because they'll call the shots. And obviously they will do anything. They're going to be a lot more partisan when it gets closer to November. But now they're talking about the court cases. He's not a lawyer. But what he's saying is when Judge Cannon doing the documents case over in Miami, took on a delay of whether the president, under the Presidential Records Act, had a right to take all those documents. He's taken under consideration. It drove Jack Smith crazy. What it means is it's pushing all this back, more deliberations, more sides on each side, more arguments. And he just wants to try this case, convict Donald Trump, and then hopefully have him lose the election. And I don't think Jack Smith would argue with anything I just said. So they're going to look to get Eileen Cannon removed from the case, saying that she's inexperienced, acting in a partisan way, and move it over to another court. That's what he thinks. I don't think so. I mean, that would be titanic. Now, in New York, the president said, hey, I have in front of the Supreme Court right now is debating whether, as president, I have immunity. Can we wait to start the Alvin Bragg trial till after the immunity case is decided? And the Judge Merchant said, no, because you should have asked me earlier. Well, it turns out he did ask earlier. He's coming back around to re-ask it. The other thing to keep in mind, everybody knows, just like the civil case, this is all about politics. But in this case, it's abundantly clear the president is lined up to fail and get convicted. Why? Judge Merchant's wife is a Democratic operative who got a $7 million contract from Adam Schiff, the archenemy of Donald Trump, who's working digital marketing with Kamala Harris. There is thoughts now and reported, and I'm looking into it, that the wife of Judge Merchant is working with Letitia James. Really? And Judge Merchant has given money to the Biden campaign. Please tell me at what point you are comfortable with this if you're Donald Trump. Why would you, if this was you and you're the defendant, would you in a moment feel confident? This is like a Russian court. The whole thing's rigged ahead of time. Question is, what would the penalty be? And is there one juror that'll say, this is not a real case. This is not election manipulation. Brian Kilmeade Show.
News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan. It's the fastest growing radio talk show. Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the latest moments of the Brian Kilmeade Show. I come to you from 48th and 6th in Midtown Manhattan, heard around the country, around the world. A lot of what's happening here is going wrong in other major cities across the country, whether it's Richmond, Virginia, or whether it's right here in New York City, over in Boston. We're seeing it. Over in Chicago, especially Seattle, and even in Florida, of all places, they're finding out illegal immigration is a top issue. What they're doing in Florida is really insidious. They are flying in people without telling the governors and mixing them in with other commercial passengers. So you might be sitting there wondering, I don't know, why does this guy have absolutely nothing on him, including a wallet? And he looks kind of beat up. Well, he might be an illegal immigrant flown in on the parole program from somewhere in Ecuador or El Salvador, and because he filled out the app correctly, he's now heading to Miami. So that's what the governor's so upset about, and he's taking action over there. And I just talk about illegal immigrants and crime that seems to be following. So before we get to Mark Thiessen and William Jacobson, Cornell University is a law professor there, let's get to the big three.
Now with the stories you need to know, it's Brian's Big Three.
Number three.
I think the evidence of her bias is pretty palpable at this stage of the game. Jack Smith, the filing today, makes it plain that she has to rule. And if she doesn't rule, under either scenario, they'll be in a position to take her up to the 11th Circuit. And I think the 11th Circuit will likely take her off the case.
Yeah, that's what Ty Cobb hopes, because he's turned on Trump. The Trump trials, documents case, a delay, a compromised judge in New York forges ahead in that case. That's going to start April 15th, despite his myriad of conflicts. What it could mean for the former president's quest to get back into the Oval Office.
Number two.
I feel that Joe will be reelected.
But when these polls, like the Wall Street Journal one, land in the White House and he's losing in all the battleground states.
No, he's not losing in all the battleground states. He's coming up and he's even or doing better.
Right. And the Mets are undefeated and on top of the baseball world. Oops. I mean, they're winless and the only winless team in Major League Baseball, one of which is true. Jill Biden, you can't deny the numbers. His campaign is now getting brand new posters. I'm talking about the Biden campaign and rallying around abortion rules as Trump focuses on the border. What message will resonate with you?
Number one.
In many cases, you're arresting the same people over and over again. This is a serious issue, and it's past time that we start taking it seriously. New Yorkers are fed up with the revolving door.
And so are other people, too, in other cities. And that is Police Commissioner Caban. Unacceptable. Once again, judges are releasing criminals, illegal immigrants at that, and putting all of us in danger, including the cops that have to keep arresting them. The latest examples of criminal squatters in the Bronx, emblematic of a bigger problem, leaving cops in the line of fire as they get arrested. The DA recommends bail, and they're let out anyway for making ICE act on their own. Mark Thiessen, you're following all of this. Speechwriter, columnist, contributor, fellow at AEI. Mark, welcome back.
Good to be with you, Brian.
So, Mark, what do you think about Jill Biden coming out and when asked about all the battleground polls in which the president has got a lead, except for Wisconsin, what do you think about her response to that? Cut 13.
People know the choice this election. They can choose chaos or they can choose, you know, steady wisdom experience. So
it's not a part of you that's a little worried because
I feel that Joe will be reelected.
But when these polls like the Wall Street Journal one land in the White House and he's losing in all the battleground states.
No, he's not losing in all the battleground states. He's coming up and he's even or doing better.
OK, so stop it, Mark. Stop reading the polls. Jill will decipher them for you. OK.
Yeah, so Jill doesn't have cognitive decline, and yet she seems to be in the same state of denial as her husband is. I mean, look, here's the thing. She's wrong that he's not behind in all the battleground states, but he's not behind by much. In most of these states, it's you know, 2 or 3 points, and that's sort of within the margin of error. So she can make an argument to herself that, you know, well, margin of error really isn't there.
That's a better answer. That's a better answer than it's not.
It would be a better answer. And you know, so, I mean, this is a problem. Joe Biden is the most unpopular president in the history of presidential polling, and yet he's within the margin of error. This election could go either way. I mean, the reality is that the Joe Biden is the most unpopular president, and he surpassed the previous record holder, which in an unpopularity, which was Trump. And so you've got two candidates who are unpopular. Trump very popular with his base, with the Republican Party, and so he has a very strong support from his base, but unpopular with swing voters. And Joe Biden unpopular with pretty much everybody, including his base, these days. And so you've got two unpopular guys. The polls show that, you know, something like 70% of Americans didn't want this rematch. They're going to get it anyway, and it could go either way. You know, and I don't think the Republicans can count on the fact. I think too many people are locking in this election because they see what a disaster Joe Biden is and think, well, yeah, there's no way he can get reelected. It's like, well, yeah, he was really unpopular in 2022, and there's no way the Democrats could hold off the red wave, and the red wave, you know, turned into a red trickle and only hit Florida and a couple other places. So, you know, we shouldn't count our chickens before they're hatched. This could go either way.
So the Democrats are real good at raising money. They're doing good. And the Republicans getting better. Seem to have gotten their act together. They announced $63 million last month, which is fine. And they're supposed to get a $30 million infusion, which is good. But it's not going to they're going to be out earned, which is going to hurt their down ticket financing. We'll see where that goes. But I think President Trump will not lose because he doesn't have enough money. I think that's pretty clear. But one thing that is going to happen is abortion. And now that it's on the ballot in Florida, does it put things in play in Mark Thiessen's mind? Because it's not 15 weeks or 5 weeks. It is 6 weeks or 23 weeks. And is Rick Scott got to be really worried now?
You know, I don't know the answer to that. I think if you look at the margin by which DeSantis won in Florida, you'd have to have a lot of abortion voters who would overcome that. But it certainly probably helps them. It's a boost to their prospects over here. But you know what? I think Florida's become such a red state that it would be great if they decided to spend a lot of their money here. I'm in Florida right now. That's why I say here.
Right.
And you know, let them spend a lot of money here like that, because that's less money they can spend in Wisconsin and a lot of the swing states. If they think, you know, the interesting thing is that if they think Florida is a swing state, that's great. Let them spend money here. You know, what's a swing state now? Maryland.
Because
at
Hogan.
At least in the Senate, because, you know, you got a chance for us to take back the Senate in Maryland. So, you know, they're going to have to spend a lot of resources there as well. So, you know, it'll be an interesting election.
So it's going to be fascinating. So, Mark, a couple of things. Things have to happen. For example, and probably the most obvious example, something's got to happen in the country to make people entertain a candidate in a race that's going to be this tight. So remember Bush 41 against Bill Clinton. So Bill Clinton from a small state in Arkansas, a small population, people like, there's no way they're going to flip away from Bush 41. Well, when foreign policy wasn't the issue and the economy was, and Clinton had the right message, it became it. When Obama, when it became about the economy and no longer about the Iraqi surge, Obama now had the upper hand against McCain, and he might probably have won anyway, but he moved much swifter in 2008. It seems as though crime and immigration, which are the breadbasket of Donald Trump, are coming more his way every day. How much does that make you feel better about his prospects?
It does. And look, on the issues, there's no way that Joe Biden should have a chance of winning re-election. I mean, and the crime and immigration have become to the top, but the economy, he gets terrible ratings on the economy. Because, and I'll tell you why he gets terrible. You know, he keeps going out and say, he stopped talking about Bidenomics, but you know, he always says, you know, oh well, you know, inflation's coming down and unemployment is low and things are getting better and you know, we have this steady leadership. And what the stat you need to understand why the Americans don't give him good ratings on the economy is when he came into office, we had the highest level of personal savings rate in the history of our country. People were flush with cash because they weren't working during COVID, and they had gotten all this government money from the COVID relief. And within 3 years, they have gone from the highest level of personal savings to the highest level of personal debt in the history of our country. Credit card debt just topped $1 trillion. And people have maxed out. So they've gone from having bank accounts flush with cash to having maxed out their credit cards. And, oh, by the way, we've had to raise interest rates to fight inflation. That means they're paying 30% on their credit card debt. So they can't even pay off – they can't even start paying off their principal. They're just paying interest every month. And so you tell people Bidenomics is making your life better, and they say, what planet are you living on?
It gets people angry. It makes people angry when they tell them how you should feel.
43%, I think, plurality of Americans say that Joe Biden's policies have personally made their lives worse. That is an enormously damaging statistic. It's all there. It's all there. But, you know, we've got if that's what the election has to be about. It can't be about a referendum on Donald Trump. If it is a referendum on Donald Trump, Donald Trump's going to lose.
What's his best pick in Mark Thiessen's mind for number two?
You know, what he needs to do is project some sort of stability and continuity with his previous term and the fact that he's not going, you know, that. So if he can't pick like a Tulsi Gabbard would be a disastrous choice. He's got to pick somebody who's going to who projects stability, normalcy, right? So a Tim Scott would be a great choice. A Marco Rubio would be a great choice. But if he starts picking somebody that signals, you know, this is going to be MAGA revenge administration, that will be, again, he's got to see it from the perspective of the swing voter. His base is going to rally behind whoever he picks because he picked them. He could pick Nikki Haley and his base would rally behind her, right? But if he picks somebody that is going to signal to the swing voters, he's got to not worry about his base so much because they're going to be with him and start worrying about the Haley voters, about the swing voters, about the people who didn't support him at that and trying to win them over because they're going to decide the election.
I'm thinking Elise Stefanik. How do you feel about that?
I like Elise Stefanik a lot. I don't know if she's the best pick for vice president, but does she appeal to those swing voters or not? That should be that's the standard. Who is going to help me with swing voters? Who is going to send the signal that I am going to be a normal president? Because, again, what people are tired of is chaos, right? The reason they voted for Biden is they were tired of the Trump chaos. And then Biden came in and took chaos to a different direction and a new level.
Yeah.
You know, it became crime chaos. It became border chaos. It became chaos on the world stage. And so, again, people are going to be voting against chaos. And so the question is, which is the less chaotic choice? Right? They're both chaotic in different ways, but Trump's winning message is not I'm going to shake things up. Trump's winning message is remember how great it was when I was president. Remember how well the economy was doing. Remember how your 401k was. Remember how you know your savings accounts were. That's the message. Bring back the stability of the, ironically, bring back the stability of the Trump years. Let's end the Biden chaos. That has to be his message. And your vice president of choice has to send that signal.
I want to tap into your foreign relations knowledge so we know about the tragic hit on those aid workers with WCK. Here is the IDF chief of general staff yesterday apologizing. Cut 29.
I want to be very clear. The strike was not carried out with the intention of harming WCK aid workers. It was a mistake that followed a misidentification at night during a war in a very complex conditions. It shouldn't have happened.
Your thoughts about how much damage was done by blowing up those seven people?
So first of all, Joe Biden expressing his outrage is disgusting because this is the guy who should know, understand better than anyone, because he misidentified a target in Kabul, Afghanistan, and killed 10 innocent people with that strike after the Abbey Gate.
Great point.
You know? So why the hell is he why is he turning on Israel when he did the exact same thing in Kabul? You know, war is hell. People make mistakes. Tragedies happen. And the idea that, and for him to issue a statement condemning Israel and expressing his outrage over the strike, all that is pandering to the pro-Hamas left-wing base of his party and throwing our ally Israel on the bus. And I'll tell you the stat that I saw recently that is the most damning for him when it comes to this issue. New Harvard-Harris poll, 53% of Americans think, majority, think that Joe Biden makes decisions on the Israel-Hamas war based on his domestic political considerations, yep, not what's best for Israel and the world, right? So that is more damaging to him than the anger of the pro-Palestinian 5% in Michigan. That alien, because he's so worried about Michigan and that for the Dearborn electorate. Do you know who else lives in Michigan? A lot of Jews. A lot of Jews live in Michigan. A lot of normal people live in Michigan who are just disgusted by this and who support Israel. I mean, this is an 80-20 issue. You know, Israel has supermajority support in the country. And so when he does this stuff, it just seems like political opportunism. It seems weak. It seems like pandering. And anybody – I saw Jose Andres say that it was intentional. It's like, why on earth would Israel do that intentionally? Who benefits from that? It's harmed them dramatically. So just this whole idea that this was anything but a mistake – And condemning Israel for this in some way is just horrible.
Mark, in the big picture, I would start every, and you're the communications expert, you're the speechwriter, but I would not start any interview, conversation, press conference without, remember why the IDF is there. They never wanted to go into Gaza. The massacre took place October 7th. Now they have no choice but to eliminate the threat. Anything short of that would be detrimental to the existence of Israel. Then I'd answer the question. Your thoughts? We have less than a minute.
100%. You know, what I would have, if Joe Biden was a competent president, he was standing on the stage in Rockefeller Center with Bill Clinton. Take a page out of Bill Clinton's Sister Soldier Soul playbook when those protesters stood up and just turn on them and say, you know something? Every civilian casualty in Gaza is the responsibility of Hamas. They started this war on October 7th. They massacred civilians. And they are now hiding behind civilians in Gaza. And the IDF doesn't want to kill civilians, and they are not committing genocide. And we stand behind Israel. We will stand with them until every Hamas fighter has either surrendered or been killed. And the whole crowd would have erupted in cheers, and he would have gotten more points for the political courage of saying that than this pandering crap that he does.
And I would say it even if the crowd erupted in boos, because it's the right thing to say. Mark, thank you so much. Have a good time in Florida.
All right, take care.
All right, 1-866-408-7669. Lay the groundwork. Your calls are next. And then we go to William Jacobson. We talk about crime out of control in way too many cities. Don't move.
It's Brian Kilmeade. The fastest 3 hours in radio. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
All right, welcome back, everyone. Went a little long with Mark Thiessen. There's never enough time with him. And someday, I think, what do you guys think? He'll invite me on his podcast? Because he'll always refer to his podcast, and he'll always talk about inviting me, and I check my phone every 7 minutes.
One day. Eric. I think he's serious. Just, you know, one day.
What's he waiting for? Teddy and Booker T's been out for 6 months.
TBD.
Right. But one thing he could do, if he wants to see me as an audition, he can come out to Las Vegas, Henderson, Nevada, on April 27th. Go to BrianKilmeade.com, especially if you're in our family of affiliates. We've got a great affiliate, K-Dawn, out there. And if we're going to be giving away some tickets on the local station, but I have a chance to go on stage and talk about great moments in American history. It's the History, Liberty, and Laughs Tour. And we reenact them and bring them to life. We actually make you feel like you're there. If you are patriotic, love the country, love to talk about things that matter most, and like inspiration, motivation, this is where to go. All right, William Jacobson's next. We talk about things that have to be tackled in this country, most likely will come up there, and that is crime in America and what happened yesterday with sanctuary cities and what we can actually do just by changing the mindset.
The talk show that's getting you talking. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Do you feel safe walking across campus by yourself?
I think I'm fearful. I mean, I'm going to have to go to classes, but there's always going to be, at least right now, that element of fear in the back of my mind.
We've always been a proponent of, you know, open and peaceful discourse, but we've also noticed that some of these demonstrations, there's kind of tiptoeing the lines between anti-Israel and anti-Semitism.
That is Jeremy Sarge and Ori Bear, and they're two students talking about what it's like at Cornell for them being Jewish at this point. Have things settled down? Have things gotten worse? If you see on the national stage, protests never stopped. They even interrupted these pro-Palestinian / Hamas protesters' Easter Sunday mass. Joining us now is William Jacobson, Cornell University law professor, founder of the EqualProtect.org, and joins us now. William, welcome.
Thanks for having me on.
What do you think about the thoughts of those two students speaking up as they were on CBS just now?
Well, I don't think much has changed in, you know, from what I observe and what students tell me. It's still a very tense atmosphere. The anti-Israel students and faculty on campus are still very aggressive. If anything, they're getting more aggressive. They are disrupting the library, disrupting students studying. The administration has attempted to, you know, put some restrictions on the use of bullhorns, electronic bullhorns, that you can't use them in the buildings, but they're doing that anyway. So I'd say things are maybe not as bad as in the fall, where there were actual threats that the FBI got involved with and arrested somebody, a student. But it's still a tense situation. It's not a good situation.
When you say protesters, are these outside people or are they fellow students?
Well, the best I can tell, these are students and faculty. Some faculty are participating, and there's a lot of faculty support for these students. And so I think it's mostly students. I can't guarantee that. I know that in past years, there have been outsiders involved. I can't say that they're involved right now. I've documented many times in the past decade or more how outside activists came onto campus to foment trouble. But I can't say for sure that that's happening right now. I would be very surprised, though, if these student groups are not receiving outside guidance. That's not the same thing as physically being on campus. But it's too organized. It's too manipulative.
I agree.
I think they're getting outside help.
From who?
Well, Students for Justice in Palestine is a national organization. They have been organizing these things around the country. They have questionable contacts with, you know, Palestine. They praise Palestinian terrorists. So I think they're probably getting help from national SJP. American Muslims for Palestine is very active. Again, I don't have the evidence they are doing it here, but I would be surprised based on what I've seen in the past if they're not consulting with these people. The group that is operating at Cornell is called the Coalition for Mutual Liberation. That's something they formed in order to conceal really who's behind it. So it's not actually a registered student group, yet they're operating on campus. And so something is very strange about what's going on at Cornell. It's too highly organized, too seemingly manipulated to be purely organic student protests on campus.
So interesting. Professor, if I came up to you before the October 7th attacks and I would say, what is the level of anti-Semitism on campus? What is the level of organization for the Palestinian cause? What would you have told me?
I would have told you a lot of the things that I'm telling you now.
Really?
The difference is now it's out in the open. So I'm somebody who has followed the anti-Israel movement on campuses really for almost 15 years, written extensively about Students for Justice in Palestine and these other groups. I've covered events at Cornell, which were highly aggressive in the past. So I always knew it was there, but it was a lid was kept on it. I think October 7th really opened it up. And what I like to tell people is, October 8th is the day we need to be looking at for campuses, because how is it that on our elite campuses, the day after, in some cases, the day of the October 7 attack, student groups organized to support it. At Harvard, I think there were over 50 student groups that immediately signed a letter saying that Israel is exclusively to blame for Hamas invading Israel, killing over 1,000 people, torturing, sexually mutilating, raping, beheading, kidnapping babies, that Israel is exclusively to blame for that. At Cornell, we had the infamous professor who gave a speech to a large crowd about how he felt exhilarated when he heard the attacks. Now, we tried to say, well, he's, of course, against targeting civilians, but I think he really was exhilarated. And so how did we get to the point on our campuses that the day after and in the days after an attack like this, they are already making excuses for it, justifying it, and in some cases, outright praising it? So I've known that the rot in our campuses has been going on for multiple decades. This really, I think, emboldened them to bring it forward.
Are you Jewish?
Yes, I am.
So do you feel it?
I don't feel it that way. I mean, certainly, you know, anybody who's kind of out in the media gets the usual harassing calls, things sure. like that. I haven't felt it directly. I'm at the law school. We're a little bit isolated, both physically and in other ways, from the rest of the campus. But I'm in touch with a lot of students. I am the student advisor to every right of center student group. And I am very much in touch with Jewish students on campus who reach out to me and have reached out to me because they know who I am. So I don't feel it directed at me personally, but I know that a lot of right. students do, including at the law school.
It just blows me away because the Palestinian situation is complex. I know Ivy League students are the best and brightest. I know. I got it. But the Palestinian cause is so convoluted, and we were heading to a time in which we were moving to the Abraham Accords. We're talking about different accords with everyone except Iran, finding a way to live with Israel. And the Palestinians seem to pass up on every opportunity on a peace plan. And whether you think they should have got more of the West Bank or less, or Sharon should have left Gaza the way he left, regardless whether there should be less security or more security or more free, that was the debate. But now it's back to the existence of Israel and the anger we're seeing in America and in London specifically caught me totally by surprise. And it is a complicated situation. Does anyone ask why Egypt, why Jordan hasn't played more of a role, open up their doors for at least temporary asylum or some type of refugee camp until they can get Hamas out? No one pressures other Arab nations because they want no part of the Palestinians either.
You know, on a lot of these campuses, it is reduced to a simple formula, which is that Israel is a white colonial state. We know that that's not true. In fact, Israel is the single best example of decolonization. I mean, the indigenous people reclaimed their land from the colonizers, but that's not how it's presented on campuses. Everything has been racialized on campuses. They want to view Israel as the white oppressor. They organize based on race. At Cornell, they form coalitions of groups of students of color against Israel. The faculty feed into that. And for at least two decades, I've been at Cornell for 16 years, and for the entirety of my time,
right.
there is a nonstop, simplistic propaganda effort against Israel, not just by students, because students come and go. They're only there for a few years, but by faculty. There's a core group of faculty. I can't give you a precise count, but I'd say it's probably 30 to 40 right. who are relentlessly exploiting their power to demonize and dehumanize Israel. And this is the result you get.
We're talking to Professor Jacobson at Cornell. Professor, what does the president of Cornell think about what you just said? If that is in fact true, is he going to put on a striped shirt and at least referee this disagreement? Or is they just sitting back and letting this play out?
Yeah, the president, I think, has been very weak on this. I mean, it's a woman who's the president. And right after October 7th, the university issued a statement But it was a wishy-washy both sides sort of statement, which didn't even condemn the Hamas attack. It said, you know, basically, we mourn for the loss of life on both sides in, you know, Israel and Palestine. I'm paraphrasing it. There was such a fury from alumni that a couple of days later, she finally issued a statement saying, oh, by not condemning the attack by Hamas, I didn't mean to not condemn it. So the administration, like many administrations, doesn't take a moral stand. It wants to both sides everything. And look, if they were staying out of it completely as a consistent matter, maybe you could justify that. I mean, I'm not thrilled with administrations telling people what to think. But the fact of the matter is, at Cornell, they frequently issue statements on matters of public importance. And if you're going to take that position that you're going to chime in on public controversies, then how did you not do it here? And how, when you finally did do it, did you do it in such a wishy-washy way? So the administration is not great.
Yeah, it sounds horrible. Here's Rabbi Ari Weiss talking about what is it like on campus and the threat. Cut 43.
It is legitimate to be scared. The post that we saw, which called for Jewish people to be murdered, right? That is not about Israel at all, right? That is a specific threat. That is incitement. That is hate speech.
So I wanted him to weigh in. You understand that, right?
Yeah, well, the issue is the administration at Cornell, like at most colleges, historically has very carefully regulated speech. We have bias response teams. We have anonymous bias reporting. We have all these mechanisms to quash speech that people don't like on campus. All of a sudden, when we have student groups with bullhorns going around calling for another intifada, calling for the elimination of Israel, calling for from the river to the sea, marching through campus like that, all of a sudden, the administration discovers the First Amendment and says, oh, well, they're entitled to say that. Well, I'm sorry. If any other group had done something similar prior to October 7th, the administration would not have discovered the wisdom of the First Amendment. They would have said it violates this campus code and that campus code, and they would have cracked down and students would have been punished. So there's a very inconsistent, and I think what the rabbi was referring to is there was a student on Cornell who posted threats to stab and shoot up the kosher dining hall on campus. And, you know, that was, I think, a reaction to the hostility from the professors and from others. I mean, as far as I can tell, that student was not a Jew hater and was not an Israel hater prior to these protests on campus demonizing Israel. So Cornell has a very deep problem. It's got a very deep problem that it has been one of the most aggressive in enforcing and imposing on the campus a DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion agenda, which racializes everything. I think that is a major source of the problem. And they're doubling down. They are defending DEI at Cornell regardless. It's their top priority.
It's unbelievable. Professor, have you guys also had a decrease in applications like Harvard?
I don't know. I'm just not privy to that information.
So let me tap into your law knowledge for a second. In 2 weeks, something historic is going to take place. The president's going to the former president's going to go on trial for this stormy, for this hush money situation dating back to the two previous elections ago. So we'll see this in a few days. When the president says, I got a problem with the judge's daughter's a political activist, took his huge contracts with Adam Schiff, with Kamala Harris marketing deal. I have a huge problem that the judge has donated to President Biden's campaign. Does he have a legitimate worry? And does he have a legitimate case to have that judge recuse himself?
Well, he should file a motion for the judge to recuse himself. And if the judge won't do it, he should try to go to an appellate court. So I think he's got legitimate concerns. This is a highly political trial. I mean, this is a trial brought by a district attorney who ran for office saying he was going to get Trump to make sure that he can't run again. So I think in this highly politicized environment, a judge who has those political connections should recuse himself. And I don't know what the mechanism would be if he refuses to, but I think that's a real problem. So I think Trump has a legitimate concern when you have a judge so tied to the campaign that Trump is running against.
But instead, they have a massive hush, a gag order. That has him not coming on the judge, his family, or anything else. And we'll see. Hopefully they'll do that because it's going to be hard enough for him to get a a fair trial in New York with a jury like that, let alone a judge that clearly wants the other guy elected. Professor, it's always great talking to you. Thanks so much. I'm sorry you have to go through this on campus, but by speaking out, you could maybe start the process of getting rid of it.
Great. Thank you for having me on.
All right. Professor Jacobson, thank you. Listen, people can relate to that. I don't care if you're Jewish or not. There's going to be situations where you hear about a murmuring of biasness against you. But this isn't a murmuring. These are massive demonstrations and a pledge to kill Jews on the elite college campuses in our country. How could that not be alarming and worthy of discussion? Back in a moment.
Giving you everything you need to know. You're with Brian Kilmeade. He's so busy, he'll make your head spin. It's Brian Kilmeade.
If you like spring skiing in the mountains, that's going to be great for you. The winds are going to cut. Was that you, Brian Kilmeade, walking behind me? What? Serious forecast here. Brian just strolls in.
It
is live television, that's true. And I'm just wrapping up with the forecast here. Stay tuned. The next hour, I will be talking about that. And hopefully, Brian Kilmeade will not disrupt my weather.
I thought you'd be outside.
Did you see that, Ainsley?
Yes, I did. I heard it. And I was like, what was that? Then you called him out on it.
Of course,
Brian. Who's always the culprit?
He's the only one that does that.
Brian.
Toss?
Brian, get it together.
Come on. All right.
It's not your time.
So I find it very upsetting that you guys would pull that soundbite from 6:20 this morning when I walked behind Janice's weather update because I thought she was outside and I just walked right by.
It's like a comedy scene. Just like, there's just some, you know, like just random guy walking and blowing a shot. Yeah, because what happened was when you guys were talking about it during the Facebook and Instagram Live this morning, Janice started the conversation by just, I'm just walking by. So you were talking about it. So afterwards, I asked Janice, when did this happen? So I went back and watched it, laughed, watched it again, laughed, and then pulled it.
Well, I will say, you would think I'd be more professional by this time. You'd think I'd have an understanding of the format on Fox and Friends. I guess I got to go to rehearsal. We have rehearsal every day at 4 in the morning.
You got to block it. You know, maybe they should, you got to block everything for you like it's a movie.
Right. That would help. So we had that going on. We also, it was a weird show because we showed the hockey fight. I mean, how unbelievable is it that in one of the major sports in the number one country in the world, at any moment, they will say, I'm not playing that sport. I'd rather fight you. Literally, they dropped the puck and they ignored the puck. Why bring the puck?
Yeah.
Why not just fight?
Well, you know,
Rangers Devils. You guys, if you haven't seen it, watch this. Is it they had a feud last time they fought. They didn't like the way one guy got hit. So they went and hired an enforcer. And then the minute they played, they dropped the puck. They ignore the puck and just fight each other. Can you imagine that if it happened in football? They're about to hike the ball. Everyone just says, screw it. Let's just fight.
It's only high. I mean, it's worse than boxing in that respect. But it's, you know, the old joke you've heard. You know, I went to a fight and a hockey game broke out.
Right. But I thought we got over that.
That's what I thought, too. But this is like classic, you know, you have an enforcer that's basically only on the ice to start fights or to be a part of a fight. But everybody fought. The puck dropped to start the game and they just, boom, gloves off, everybody fought.
And then they fought. And then the Rangers played a nail-biter 4-3.
4-3, yep.
Matt Rempe is 6'7", and they actually, the Devils signed Curtis McDermott in order to fight him the next time they played. Can you believe this?
This is what I grew up remembering or what I would read about in the 70s with like teams like the Flyers.
Yeah. They used to have Dave Schultz, Clark Gillies, Nick Fatiu. These are guys that were decent skaters. Marty McSorley. But they're really there to protect their star players, whether it's Brian Trotche or Wayne Gretzky.
The Hanson brothers
in real life. Great. It is really back to early man, before we had roads and bridges and cars.
From high atop Fox News headquarters in New York City, always seeking solutions, never sowing division. It's Brian Kilmeade.
All right, this is the latest moment of the Brian Kilmeade Show. So glad you're here. I come to you from Midtown Manhattan, where the only thing that kept crime down yesterday, I believe, was the driving rainstorm. I do feel as though, and I've been here, I'm coming back and forth now for 25 plus years, I do feel as though things are really strange in New York City. I don't know if I've been reading too much about crime or seen too much, but there is so much drug use and people mentally deranged, whether they're on something, walking around here. And even when I come here at, I'm walking to the building like 3:50 in the morning, a.m., it is strange. There's between the 67,000 illegal immigrants that we're housing, let alone the ones that are squatting places, there's a sense of unrest in major cities. And I think it's in Chicago. I think you would say, I'm hearing the same thing about Philadelphia, Boston, as well as San Francisco and Los Angeles. Bill Hemmer's coming in the bottom of the hour to put some perspective on it. And of course, I'm referring directly to what's happening in the Bronx, where the basement of this house, these squatters just took over about a dozen. A kid is in there. There's a woman in there. There's drugs. There's guns. There's guys that were up for attempted murder, illegal weapons possession, all illegal immigrants arrested. The DA recommends $150,000 bail, and the judge says, no, I don't think so, and they're all out, which prompted ICE to act and detain three of them. Ian Pryor joins us now, author of Parents of the World Unite, senior advisor at American First Legal, and executive director of Fight for Schools. Ian, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Brian.
Ian, first off, I got to tap into your legal knowledge just a little bit. You know how the NYPD's hands are tied with this bail reform, although the sanctuary city status too. Can you understand this frustration that we heard yesterday after the arrest of eight and the release of most of them, of these illegal immigrants? The NYPD Chief of Patrol, Chief John Chell. Listen, four.
The first person that ran to the back with a firearm had an open attempted murder case from Yonkers. The second person here, open gun indictment in the Bronx. Judge released him on supervised release. I don't know what supervised release means.
And he's a cop and he's a chief. This is, if you're a cop, Ian, why would I go in and try to bust these squatters in a basement? They're cavalierly just breaking all our laws, coming here illegally and selling drugs. Ketamine was in there. And they don't care about weapons charges. They don't show up for court. Have we reached a breaking point?
Yeah, you know, we've seen this for a while, certainly with law enforcement. I mean, the more handcuffs you put on law enforcement, you're going to get people that start to say, you know, I'm not going to go and risk my life and put myself in this situation if I can't do my job. If this person is just going to be out on the street the next day, what am I doing going in here? You know, I might get shot. Something may happen, and he's just going to be out the next day. So there's, you know, it creates this disincentive for robust enforcement, and certainly you cannot blame law enforcement for that. I mean, they want to do their job. That's why they signed up for it. But they're being prevented from doing it by the politicians.
So what happened is they recommend about $150,000 bail for these guys, and this Judge Eugene Bowen, again, the weakest guy in crime in Manhattan, perhaps, says no problem, no bail.
Yeah, I mean, it's really unbelievable. I worked for a while as a lawyer for the police department in the city of Boston. And, you know, even back then, you started to see, like I said, the handcuffs being put on the police with, you know, consent decrees and whatnot. And, you know, I would hear stories from cops where they'd say, look, you know, sometimes I just sit in my car and sit in the back of the station because, you know, I'm going to get out there and I'm going to get sued. I'm going to get an internal affairs complaint put on me for something that was absolutely ridiculous, but they keep changing the rules, and they've done this. You know, we're seeing the, like you said, the tipping point now, but this has been going on really for 20, 30 years of reducing the ability of law enforcement to enforce.
Right. Since 94, when they passed the crime bill, which Joe Biden ushered through, then we started slowly but surely taking back control of these cities and streets. And now they overcorrected if you needed correction at all. And now it's up to the criminals, and it's the same criminals. I just want people at home to listen from the police perspective. They know 1 week ago we had an officer walk up on a career criminal with 21 arrests, only two prison stints, and cavalierly just shoot him in the chest and kill him. Knowing that, at the NYPD, that's Jonathan Viller. Let's hear more from the chief. Cut six.
That basement apartment, they recovered two additional guns. So it'll be four altogether, one being a ghost gun. They recovered two bags of, now we know it was ketamine, which mixed with cocaine, one bag of white, one bag of pink. In that apartment also is a 7-year-old child. And then according to the landlord, he does not know any of these people that live there. Rent hasn't been paid in months, and they are clearly squatting.
So you got the cop problem. They're not backed up. You got the squatting problem, which is prevalent everywhere in this country, sadly. And then you got the legal immigrant problem, who are here just to create havoc in our country. So it's very rare when you have all our problems wrapped up in one.
Yeah, and you mentioned the crime bill in 1994. And what happened there was people would get thrown in jail for 10 years, right? And then you get to 10 years later, and they're all back on the streets, right? But unfortunately, there wasn't sort of a reinvigoration of law enforcement at that time. Certainly under the Trump administration, I think you saw a push back towards, robust law enforcement from the Department of Justice, certainly from the Department of Homeland Security. But under the Biden administration, we've gone back, further than ever. I mean, it is dangerous out there in the cities. People have to, are you going to take your kids to New York City for Christmas to Rockefeller Center? No. Well, why would you do that knowing that anywhere you are, it's not safe? This isn't the New York City of Rudy Giuliani in the 90s. I mean, this is a very different place, and you're looking at it all across America. And then you add, yes, the influx of illegal aliens into those cities, and it's become a hellscape.
Right. I know, too. They got the brutality of MS-13 gang. They're from El Salvador. Many of them are arrested in El Salvador. So they're coming here. And Governor Glenn Youngkin yesterday vowed to hold a group of MS-13 members available because they just killed a canine who was there working with police. So he was highly trained. His name was Rivan. And they just stabbed him to death. So this is the type of people that they don't care about life, they don't care about police, and these are the people that we're allowing to come in here, and they even come in with the neck tattoos and the NBA jackets and let you know the gang they're in. So, it's bad enough having Americans who go wrong, the Bloods and Crips, but now we're importing criminals. It's just insane. I want to, if I can, talk to you about what's going to be happening in New York with this Stormy Daniels trial. And the president's team is on a mission to expose how compromised this judge is. Well, number one, they have a daughter that's a left-wing activist, has done got millions of dollars to work for Kamala Harris on an online marketing, got $7 million contract to work with Adam Schiff. And you have a judge that has already contributed to the Biden campaign, even though it's not much money. If that's me and I'm the defendant, how would I possibly feel confident I'm going to get a fair trial?
Yeah, and it's not just, whether you get a fair trial or not, it's the appearance of a fair trial. When we're talking about conflicts of interest, it's not just, say, you have a conflict of interest, but it's also the appearance of that, which the appearance of a conflict of interest decreases people's faith in our justice system. So a really appropriate thing for any judge to do, a high-standing judge with integrity to say, look, I can understand, while I can judge this case fairly, I understand the appearance of conflict here. And so it is incumbent upon me to recuse myself so that appearance of conflict does not taint the proceedings. That's what should happen. But, unfortunately, you're seeing this all over the place. Activist judges that, look, they're gonna put the law second, right? They're gonna have their, and we've had this throughout our nation's history, but we're gonna come to a result, and then we're gonna figure out a way to work the law that we want in there, and then they can deal with it on appeal. I mean, that's looks to be what's happening here.
When we talk about the documents case, it looks like Eileen Cannon is going to consider whether the Presidential Records Act does apply here, and it's driving Jack Smith nuts. And he says he's going to apply to a different court to kick this judge off. I'm not sure if they're going to be successful, but among the people that think he's going to be successful is Ty Cobb. He came out and says she is so incompetent, it's time to kick her off. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's going to be very difficult to dislodge a judge in this case, especially the high-profile nature. Again, I mean, you're talking about something that goes to the integrity of the process. And if, whereas something in New York where you have a judge that clearly has conflict, right, that's a place where, all right, maybe that judge should be recused. But when you have another judge and you just don't like the rulings, then you're going to try and kick that judge off. That's another way where it looks like the integrity of the judicial system is now being manipulated by, we don't like your ruling. You know, this is really why, when you get to the heart of it, you know, presidents should not be prosecuted for what they've done in office. That is written into the Constitution as impeachment, right? If we're allowed to prosecute presidents for their conduct in office after they've left office, you are looking at a return to, you know, the end of the Roman Republic, right? That is exactly what happened there, where you say, oh, well, you know, we don't like what Caesar did in his time as consul, so we're going to prosecute him. And then what happened? Oh, Caesar comes in and takes over. You don't want that. You do not want that as part of this republic. We have a constitution. We have to follow the constitution, and we can't be going out and prosecuting our, you know, previous presidents for everything they've done for political reasons.
I think the evidence of her bias is pretty palpable at this stage of the game. And I think that Jack Smith, I think the filing today makes it plain that she has to rule. And if she doesn't rule under either scenario, they'll be in a position to take her up to the 11th Circuit. And I think the 11th Circuit will likely take her off the case. I think the evidence is just too overwhelming. I mean, you know, yes, she may be incompetent, but her incompetence is so gross that I think it clearly creates the perception of partiality and her attempt to put her thumb on the scale. So I think that should disqualify her.
You don't agree, obviously.
No, I don't. And I think it's, you know, amusing, but also serious that you have these two different cases where, you know, one where you really have actual evidence of conflict. Nobody's talking. They're not talking about that on that clip. No, they're talking about the case where things are going well for President Trump or the ruling may favor him. You know, it's so transparent what everybody's trying to do from the media to the federal government when it comes to the former president. And, you know, I think people should look at these things with a very skeptical eye.
Yeah, I guess we're going to see what happens. But how do you feel about people who look at immunity and say, well, if the president decided to take out a gun and just start shooting people, is he immune from prosecution?
Well, you know, what I'm talking about is the official duties, right, that a president engages in when he's in office, right? I mean, if we're talking about, you know, going on a killing spree, that is different. That's not part of your official duties. But if you're going after him, as you say, like in the documents case, right? I mean, that is not something that you can do if you're not president. You cannot have those documents. So I think that there is a difference between just sort of run-of-the-mill activity that is not connected to presidential powers that are just, you know, general crimes that exist, you know, throughout society at a day-to-day level, and what they're going after him for, which is exercising his power and his role as the president of the United States, because of course the other side's going to disagree with it. That's why we have elections.
Ian Pryor, our guest, and Ian, my exit question to you is, if the president does these 6-7 weeks, and this trial, the Alvin Bragg trial, starts on April 15th, they have a jury selection, takes a couple of days, then they get started. The president has to sit there Monday through Thursday. Is that correct? And number two, if it results in, it's got to be a unanimous ruling from the jury. So if they can't flip that one juror and he is convicted, do you think the president goes to jail on something like this?
Well, you know, I think he's going to be in appeals for years after that, right? So it's not like he's just going to take that one. He will immediately appeal it. That's going to take a lot of time. Then it, you know, depending on that, it could go to the Supreme Court, which is going to take a lot of time. So, you know, that's the thing, is that the timing of this, you know, it just reeks of political opportunism because ultimately there's not going to be a resolution before the election. There will not be a final resolution unless he's acquitted. If he's acquitted, that's a resolution. But if they flip a juror and it's, you know, they get unanimous, it's going to go to appeal, and this will continue to go on and be a stain on, you know, on really this administration.
And what they would get is, will the president win an election if he is can be called in a convicted felon? Does it bother him, or do they see more pure politics in a case as ridiculous as this is? Ian, final thought on that?
Yeah, well, I mean, you look at the polls. Every time they do something on these issues, the former president's numbers go up. Because I think people look at this and say, this is persecution. This is not prosecution. This is persecution.
Ian, thanks so much. Look forward to catching up to you in studio. He's with he's senior advisor, America First Legal. He's got a great organization sticking up for parents, Parents of the World Unite, and executive director of the Fight for Schools. Ian, good job. Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Brian.
All right. When we come back, I'll be able to take some of your calls. Also, you're going to hear how David Axelrod feels about this. From the political standpoint, what are these court cases, what have they done, and what will they do? Don't move.
Expanding your knowledge base. It's the Brian Kilmeade Show. Information you want. Truth you demand. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
It's also the way that you talk about it. When the word of ban is being thrown around, Republicans are losing. When you start talking about simple limitations, reasonable limitations, and talk about the extreme being third trimester abortion and partial birth, Republicans are winning. So they have to run to fight that fight and stake their position and make it clear as a bell where they stand and where the extremists in abortion really are and who they are.
So that was Robert Cahalli of the Trafalgar Group. Yesterday, he was on with Sean Hannity on this television show and just saying when it comes to abortion, that is where, when Roe v. Wade was lifted, where Dobbs won out. So now you have a situation where every state's deciding. When they decide, even the most red state wants some type of abortion rights above 6 weeks. Governor DeSantis said, no, 6 weeks is going to be it. And now it's going to be on the docket in November, November 5th. So when you go to vote, you are going to decide, are you going to go for 6 weeks? Are you going to go for 23 weeks? So what Robert Crowley is saying is Republicans should not talk about yes or no. They should talk about accept the exceptions on rape, incest, or something with the health of the baby or the mother. Got it. And number two, go to a week of 15 weeks. Even if you're the most pro-life person in the world, you're most likely a Republican. And if you're a Republican that wants to have a degree of power, you have to come up with a compromise because the American people are not there right now. And the pro-life group seems to have knuckled under after getting their big victory. So that's why the wisdom of the 6 weeks didn't make sense, even for Donald Trump when they were going at each other in the primary. Now, Trump is going to come out and make a major announcement where I think he's going with it. I think he's going to say 15 weeks. And he says, we are for a national referendum on 15 weeks, and he's going to put that up as a bill. Now, will that tick off some of the evangelicals? Perhaps. But knowing Trump, he's in regular contact with him. He's really running to try to maximize the Christian vote. They have seen what happened over the last two elections, and they saw that there would have been a red wave if it wasn't for that, the overturning of Roe v. Wade. So I think they'll get on board with it. Trump will be from ahead of time. Plus, I don't know if you've noticed, but he can be quite persuasive, I should say. Bill Hemmer, he's next.
From his mouth to your ears, it's Brian Kilmeade.
Well, I think it helps him a lot. There's a big body of evidence in polling that a conviction in any of these cases, but in these federal cases in particular, would be harmful to him. And his goal has been clearly throughout to try and delay all of these trials beyond the election. So it feels like this judge who he appointed is in the tank, and she's done what he wanted, which is to help delay this trial beyond where it could be tried before this election.
David Axelrod doing some analysis on Eileen Cannon's decision to take into account the Presidential Records Act and possibly delay the start of the trial, much to the consternation of Jack Smith. And I just and people are just agonized over at the place you used to call home, Bill Hemmer, CNN, because they just want to see this guy convicted.
Yeah, nice to be with you, Brian. And I was reading last night about what the claims are and how Jack Smith's got such a problem. But I think she was asking whether she can include in the jury instructions whether or not this material was in his personnel possession or his presidential possession. But the Presidential Records Act does exist. So initially, you have to answer that question before you can get a trial underway. But yeah, the consternation is significant. But I mean, the way I read the law, you know, Judge Cannon's got to figure this out first.
So Ty Cobb, the former attorney to Donald Trump, who clearly doesn't like him now, says that Eileen Cannon is on her way to being removed. They got to go above her head.
I heard that. I read that. You know,
your thoughts on that?
Did you read the entire Hur report?
Yes.
You did?
With highlights.
Okay.
So I could always go back to
it. How many days did it take?
3.
Okay.
Because I would try to read it to understand it. What I also do is this. I highlight different areas because I know I want to go back to. I read the Hur report, and I'm so glad you said that. And before I let you do the follow-up, Joe Biden didn't do this for 1 year. He did it over the course of 40 years. He has taken classified documents and not returned them or never given them up. And then when he went to meetings when he was vice president, he took notes and took cards and took them with him.
So
he didn't leave with the documents, but he left with the intelligence.
Here's the point for your listeners. Is there so many examples that I think you can find in the Hur report that directly parallel or might be even worse?
Because he wasn't president.
Possibly even significantly worse than the allegations against Donald Trump. And I guess we got to figure that out in this jury in Southeast Florida. He had a ghostwriter. He told the ghostwriter this classified information.
He said that.
On and on and on it goes. So you can find all this stuff in the Hur report, and then you got to ask yourself, what's the difference, right? And you mentioned it. He was never president in 2009. When he was advising Obama and what he would do about the ramp-up of troops in Afghanistan, Biden was against it. Obama made a different decision, went in the other direction. My feeling is, just my theory, is that Biden wanted to preserve the record so someday he could say that his boss was wrong. And I think that's probably why he did that.
Right. But you have to say to yourself, too, I've been doing this for 40 years. I'm violating the law if I take this with me. So that is the big issue. On top of that, the subplot was this guy was absolutely beside himself to get out of the Afghanistan war. Yeah. And if you see the way he left, just like blind rage, get out of the war, get out of the war. That's what I'm going to do. I don't care how it is. I'll blame the other guy for leaving me a bad plan and option. And then he blows up all the generals.
Like
you watch the testimony.
It's like
that's the subplot.
The Sam Kinison line. What do you say? Grab your kids. We'll make one trip. We'll get the hell out of here. He was talking about famine in Africa back then. This goes back 30 years. But just one other point, and I don't know if I'm onto something here or not. Jonathan Turley or Andy McCarthy would give you much better analysis than I can because I'm not a lawyer and I've never been trained in law. But as cable news anchors that we are, we deal in law every day.
Every day.
Here's just one query I have. Is that why I've heard all these analysts, and you could argue they're, you know, that maybe they're conservative analysts or Republican analysts. I don't know how Turley votes. I don't know how McCarthy votes. I have an idea how McCarthy votes.
Turley tells you he's a Democrat. You know that.
I haven't heard that from him.
Okay.
But I'm not saying you're wrong about that.
Pete, could you be my second source on that?
So
I'll be your second and third source.
Okay, go ahead.
All right, good. So he must have said it here then. All right, that's good information for me to have the next time I have Turley on.
Unless the data
So they have all – well, then I call you guys,
yes,
right?
Yes, thank you.
So these analysts have had a real problem with all these trials in New York. You know, Andrew Cherkasky, you've had him on your show maybe.
Yeah.
Great
guest.
Really good guest. And he's on the other day. He goes, look, just go find another judge. There's clearly a conflict of interest within this guy's own family. Talking about Merchan here and what his daughter has done for Democratic causes. And I think Merchan's on record as donating money.
Joe Biden.
If you were a judge, why would you give money to anyone?
What are you thinking?
I'm a reporter. I would never do that. Okay?
You want to hear Turley say it? Or would you rather?
We can't, but I just want to get to Okay, you want to play Turley? It's your show.
No.
Okay, cut 21.
But with 2 weeks to go, it'd probably be easier to move the courthouse than the judge in this case. And the reason is that they are very reluctant, unless you have something quite direct and sort of unassailable. We don't know what they have, but generally the activities of an adult child do not prove determinative for these types of motions. That once that child is an adult, then they're not really, their actions are not attributed to those of the judge or vice versa.
Okay. Good?
Yeah.
Here's my point. Just like they're challenging all these judges in New York, maybe the judge in Florida is watching them with the same vision. And she's thinking, guys, you got this stuff upside down. And she's approaching it in a way that maybe Jack Smith and others did not expect.
Right.
But she's seeing it from her own eyes of justice. And she's probably thinking that 465 million dollar fine might have been a tad excessive considering it has never happened in the history of the judicial system of the United States against one individual.
Right. That's a civil case, which was knocked down $175 million bond, which he was able to get. So that puts that on the shelf. Now, when Merchant starts, all they have to do is convert one jury. So when the judge comes out, one juror. So, I mean, basically, unless he has a really good offense, a really good defense, there's an excellent chance the president will be convicted on this. And then what changes? He appeals.
Yeah, he appeals. That's right. But he's got a conviction on his record momentarily while the appeal is happening, correct?
And does certain people not vote for him because of that?
Maybe. I don't know. I don't think we're at that point yet. I know there's some polling 2 months ago that was conducted, and I think up to 25% of Republicans said they would not vote for anyone who had a conviction on their record. Maybe that's true. Maybe it's not. I don't know.
But if they see a case like this, they feel differently.
In New York, you've got 7-1 Democrats and Republicans in the five boroughs, and that's just the reality that he's up against, and maybe you do find one juror. I think jury selection will be very interesting. I wonder what sort of leaks will come out of that courtroom that will give us some indication as to whether or not they may have found someone who might be favorable toward him. I don't know.
It would be, because jury selection is probably the most critical thing.
Absolutely. In this case, for sure.
Right. So we're going to take a short time out. I want to have a good segment on the other side and maybe even do a more to know. Bill Hemmer's here for another segment, right?
Absolutely.
All right. You wouldn't even leave if I wanted you to.
I am here for you.
America.
And America.
Back in a moment.
Both sides, all opinions. It's Brian Kilmeade. A talk show that's real. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
People know the choice this election. They can choose chaos or they can choose, you know, steady wisdom experience. So
it's not a part of you that's a little worried because off kilter a little
bit. I feel that Joe will be reelected.
But when these polls, like the Wall Street Journal one, land in the White House and he's losing in all the battleground states.
No, he's not losing in all the battleground states. He's coming up and he's even or doing better.
Okay, that's a little bit of a problem. I understand defending your husband, but numbers are numbers. So you are losing in the battleground states. You are tied in Wisconsin. It has reversed itself in Nevada. You do are trailing in Georgia, which you won last time. You are trailing by 4 in Arizona. There's just polls, Wall Street Journal poll. You could say you don't like the poll, Bill Hemmer, but if you're Jill Biden, you can't say, no, it's not. Much like her husband, who screamed when asked, why are you trailing all the polls? I'm not in the last 5 polls. You're reporting the wrong polls. So this is bizarre.
Yeah, I mean, we're going to do this for 7 months, I think. I mean, honestly.
But these are numbers.
Yeah, and in the end, we're going to find out which poll was right, as we always do. But sometimes we forget to go back and check and see who got it right.
Right.
We forget that. That'd be a good job for you.
Or for
I could
me.
Be, actually.
Because I thank you.
Wait, actually, that's my job.
Yeah, could you do that? I mean, what do I have to do it? I mean, you get the election coverage, and I got to go do the aftermath?
All right. I'll manage that for you. I thought the polling was interesting, but I think it's also consistent, Brian, with what we have seen, not on a national level, but in what I call the Magnificent Seven. Right. You got Stuart Varney over in Fox Business talking about the Magnificent Seven. Those are the amazing stocks, Microsoft, Google, Meta,
Apple.
I'm missing 2 others. But these 7 battleground states are your Magnificent Seven. However, I think there could be some movement that people aren't looking at right now. Maybe like a Minnesota that's not in that category. You know, they'll tell you within the campaign on the Trump's team that there are a lot of suburban voters out there. And crime's become an issue. Immigration has become an issue. And they think it might be ripe for a little bit of a flip.
And there's no nuance when it comes to who's tougher on crime and who's better on the border. There's not one poll that's close. And
that's why
those are the issues in America.
That's why Biden has taken over the last 10 days so much of his attention back to health care. And I think he took that advice from Barack Obama, and he's following through so far.
Right. And what do you think the Republican strategy is at? Donald Trump already disavowed saying, I'm not looking to get rid of Obamacare, so stop it. I'm not looking to get rid of Medicare, so stop it. I don't know if they're going to stop it. But he did say one time we're going to do something better than Obamacare. But the president since that time says, no, I'm not going to do it. We're going to make it better. So that's relatively smart, I think.
Yeah, I'd agree with that.
Right.
I mean,
they want to talk about prescription drugs and insulin.
Look, they're already predicting $4 gas in the summertime. You don't. If you go to $4 gas, Brian, you're going to be up a dollar in 6 months. All right, I'm from Ohio. When I was home at Christmas time, it was $3.
So,
all right, $2.99. I went back a couple weeks ago. It's $3.50 everywhere, and we're going to tack another 50 cents onto that. That matters.
You know the story is going to be when Biden's done in 6 months or 4 years. What did they do to keep the price down? And what they did is let Iran sell their oil and let Venezuela sell their oil. And they brought them into the fray, and we were drilling more. Whatever we're doing, and we're drilling at an all-time high right now, we would be doing astronomically more if there were a different person in the White House. And I'm going to ask you, what do you think about the about this whole climate change agenda? They say young people care about it, but now we're getting to the point where we can see that gas-powered cars are going to sunset. Selling gas-powered cars is going to sunset in Los Angeles, New York perhaps, other states that are going to buy into this and say, we're going to copy that. Do you think the American people are willing to give up their gas-powered cars?
I'm not sure, but I do know young Americans do care about the climate. They talk about the environment all the time, and I don't know where that comes from, but it comes from that generation for sure. Secondly, you mentioned production at an all-time high. That is never talked about. And why? Because the progressive left would go nuts. But it is true, and it might be his only it might be his best option to try and keep a handle on gas prices.
So he can't brag about something he did because it makes him look bad.
Not going to happen.
So the other thing is when he put a sunset, when he stopped signing off on these natural gas leases, especially in Pennsylvania, says no more natural gas drilling. Really? Where'd that come from? Well, that was an homage to his left. Well, people like Lithuania, Estonia, they go, excuse me, you told me to stop buying Russian natural gas, that you would supply it? Are you going to stop? Yeah, pretty much. So now what Speaker Johnson's talking about doing is doing what Nancy Pelosi has done in the past. You want Ukraine aid, right, Mr. President? Absolutely. Start signing off on some of those leases.
And he said he would not go for that. But maybe
who said he would not?
Biden did. He said he's not going to do that. You can't have the LNG in that bill. Maybe he changes his mind. Maybe there's a negotiation to be had there. We'll see.
Well, I think that it's fascinating because you can't wait much longer in Ukraine before the whole thing collapses. And I think Speaker Johnson knows, like McConnell, that that's the right thing to do. He's not on the shelf like J.D. Vance. J.D. Vance does not believe this 60 Minutes feature on the microwaves and the Havana syndrome hurting our diplomats. I just find it very interesting because now if you go against Russia, you're a liberal. If you're with Russia, you're ultra conservative. I don't understand. Mm-hmm. Do you follow where we're going right now?
No, I don't. I think the lines have been crossed, but they've been crossed for several years. Eight, I would say, starting in 2016. I mean, the political world in America was flipped on its head, and we're still trying to sort it out.
But the one thing I tell people that are against Ukraine aid, and I'm all for it, and I know people's worry about bullets getting to the front line and money being stolen and slow walking of weapons. Those are all legitimate things. If you could call yourself a conservative, I haven't met one Republican who doesn't say nice things about Ronald Reagan and say, wish we had him.
Okay.
Reagan would have given Ukraine everything they needed.
Yeah, you're probably
it would have been
right
against Russia.
But Reagan may not have ever taken us as close to war as we got. I mean, we were poking him in the eye for a while, and we poked too far.
Who?
Putin. And
I don't think we
look in November of 2021. Anthony Blinken hosted a delegation from Ukraine in Washington, D.C. I've read the document. It's like 75 pages long. In that document, there's one sentence that says we recognize the desire of the Ukrainian government to one day be a member of NATO.
Sure.
I'm looking at that. I'm thinking, was that necessary? I'm going through 75 pages of material here. And in hindsight, Brian, was it necessary to include a line like that where you forced the world to make a choice? You forced every government on this planet to make a decision which side they are on. Anyway, that's water under the bridge. The point today is that even if you're able to give Ukraine the weaponry to fight back against Russia, do you think they have the ability to move the front line where it is today? I think that is a very difficult proposition when it comes to war.
Well, offhand, I'm not teaching war college. I'll give you that. But offhand, one of the main reasons they didn't have more of an offensive last year was the fact they took off for the winter and they allowed Russians to mine the whole place.
Absolutely.
And they're stuck on the ground. They have no air power.
Yeah, I agree with that. The whole place is mined.
There's,
maybe six or seven times over.
If you give them F-15s, F-16s, they'll now have an Air Force. And they'll start to making these guys pay a price. And that's just it.
We'll see. I think we could keep going round and round on this. I think what happened 2 days ago, though, was quite telling.
Which is?
The Ukrainians, they brought drone attacks 800 miles into Russia. Does that change things? I don't know. But it's my sense today that where the war is in all likelihood where the war is going to end.
Right. You know who condemned that action?
Who?
Secretary of State Anthony Blinken. I do not support Ukraine hitting oil fields in Russia. So it's all right for Russia.
That one. Sorry, I thought you were talking about the current boundaries of the war.
It's all right for Russia to try to take out every power grid in Ukraine. But if they blow up an oil field in Russia, how dare you?
Yeah, I get it. I get it. I get it. By the way, you have a listener every day. His name is Chris Hughes.
Is he a good guy?
He's a PAO from the Marines. Lives down in Virginia now. Born and raised in Hawaii.
Sounds like a good guy.
We met in Kandahar, Afghanistan in 2001. And I was there for a month. I said, Chris, I never served. But if I served, what branch of military would I be in? He said, oh, you'd be in the Air Force. I said, why the Air Force? He goes, because they build the runway last after the golf course. And at the end of my tour, I said, hey, Chris, what would I be? He said, you'd be a U.S. Marine.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network.
Hey there, it's me, Kennedy. Make sure to check out my podcast, Kennedy Saves the World. It is 5 days a week, every week. Download and listen at foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you listen to your favorite podcast.
Listen to the show ad-free on Fox News Podcast Plus, on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music with your Prime membership, or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.